Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Codeine has been a hot topic since the announcement was made that it would be rescheduled to prescription only from the 1st of February 2018. One of the consequences may be the emergence of a group of patients who are only just now understanding that they may be codeine dependent. Dr. Suzanne Nielsen is a senior research fellow with the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. She and her colleagues, Dr. Tim McDonald and Dr. Jacinta Johnson, have written a systematic review of the identification and treatment of codeine dependence, which is published online by the MJA from the 12th of February. Dr. Nielsen is my special guest today. Codeine is in the news a lot. We've just had the rescheduling. Do we know how much codeine Australians were using before the rescheduling?
Look, we had a detailed investigation that was published with data from 2013. And in that we had over 15 million packets of over-the-counter codeine products that were sold every year through pharmacies. That's just community pharmacy supply.
Is that a lot? I mean, compared to other countries, is that a lot? Do we know?
Oh, I don't have a good comparison to other countries, to be honest, but I think Australia is one of the higher consumers of codeine in the world.
Okay. Explain to me a little bit about codeine. It's a prodrug. What does that mean?
So when codeine is taken, codeine in the body itself doesn't have very much analgesic effects. So most of the analgesic effects we understand to come from codeine being metabolised into morphine.
It's often mixed with other analgesics. Does that make it more effective in pain relief?
Yeah, and in fact, codeine on its own is not very effective as an analgesic at all.
Okay.
We see very high numbers needed to treat in the systematic reviews that have looked at the efficacy of codeine on its own, looking at around sort of 15 or 16 people needed to treat to get one person with a 50% reduction in pain. When they're combined with other analgesics like codeine or ibuprofen, we do see a much greater effect. So there does seem to be some sort of synergistic effect of codeine and paracetamol or simple analgesics. Although, in fact, when we look at the effect of those simple analgesics on their own, it's fairly comparable to the combination product. So we don't see a lot of added benefit from that low dose of codeine in the over-the-counter products.
So how did it get to be so popular?
That's a good question. I mean, this is a medication that's been around for a long period of time, and both pharmacists and consumers are very familiar with it. I think, you know, back in, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there weren't quite as many different analgesic products available on the market. I mean, I think Panadine was available before ibuprofen was available without a prescription, for example. So we have had more effective analgesics come onto the market in more recent years that probably don't have the risks of codeine, but people are still probably used to purchasing those codeine products.
Why don't we know exactly how many Australians are dependent on codeine? Is that data that's particularly difficult to collect?
Yeah, look, some of the research that I've done looking at over-the-counter codeine dependence has shown that it's a very hidden problem. People are quite embarrassed or ashamed to have developed a problem with a pharmaceutical medication, particularly an over-the-counter one. And so I think when we look at our treatment data, that's likely to be the tip of the iceberg, really, because many people try and manage it themselves or don't seek help.
Yeah.
We did a study where we identified people who were meeting criteria for codeine dependence. And of those people who met criteria for codeine dependence, only one in four had sought any kind of help.
What are the consequences of overuse?
So as we found in our systematic review, when people use very high doses, particularly of these combination products with paracetamol or ibuprofen, we can get really significant organ damage. So we start to see things like people having liver damage, having gastrointestinal symptoms, including, duodenal ulcers and things. Also effects on the kidney, and we do see cases of hyperkalemia. Quite significant effects on people's organs from taking these very high doses for long periods of time.
To the point where it can be fatal or not reversible?
Certainly to the point that it can be fatal in some cases. So in our systematic review, we identified a couple of fatal cases. And also in some of the opioid-related mortality statistics from the National Drug and Alcohol Research Center. They've also identified in there a number of codeine-related deaths.
Let's talk a little bit about your systematic review. Why did you decide to do it, and what did you actually look at?
We decided to do this because there was talk of the rescheduling, and I was talking with some of my colleagues that I co-authored this review with, and we were really talking about it from a health professional perspective, and that there isn't a lot of information out there about this problem of over-the-counter codeine dependence in particular, but codeine dependence more general, that might help a health professional identify when somebody was having problems with over-the-counter codeine to try and see if there were better ways to identify dependence, what sorts of characteristics were associated with dependence, and also if you do identify a case of codeine dependence, how you might treat it and what evidence is out there. So we really wanted to do a very practical systematic review that would help inform health professionals, given the scheduling had been mooted at that point. And we just didn't feel like there was a lot out there to inform health professionals if they did identify people who had needs in this area.
So what kind of things did you look at?
So firstly, we looked at all of the studies that we could identify where there were people who had identified codeine dependence and tried to look at the characteristics of codeine dependence in that group to see if we could identify some good markers or things that might help identify a patient that might be likely to fall into that group. We also looked to see if there were any key ways to screen for codeine dependence, but we didn't really identify that in the review.
If I'm a GP and a patient walks through my door, what questions should I be asking, and what characteristics should I be looking for if I suspect codeine dependence?
Well, one of the findings of the review is that it's a really diverse population of people that appear to be affected by codeine dependence, so certainly not making any judgment based on the person's appearance or background, because it does seem to affect a wide number of people. If people are presenting after the rescheduling, now asking for a prescription for codeine, definitely getting a good details about how people were using over-the-counter codeine prior to the change, so what sort of doses were being used, what condition it was being used for, and also other comorbidities. So we found relatively high prevalence of mental health comorbidities, for example, and that often was part of the picture of escalating codeine use, where there were other stresses in someone's life that were contributing to that use. So trying to understand a bit about the background, the reasons that the codeine was being used and just how much was being used, getting down to details of the dose and the frequency and how long that's been going on for. We know that often people don't initially provide those details, so it does involve having a good rapport with the patient to be able to elicit that information with some level of trust. And also, I guess, some confidence that we have some really good treatments out there available. So one of the things that we've found is people aren't aware of the fact that there are treatments available for codeine dependence, and this is something that can be managed. So I guess having the confidence that there are places that people can be referred to, or it can be treated in primary care as well with the treatments we have available, I think that can help kind of have confidence with the patient that this is something that can be managed.
Right. So you mentioned treatments. Let's talk about them. What's the first front line?
It's going to depend on the patient presentation. So our review focused very much on dependence. So, you know, often that was defined using sort of DSM or ICD-10 kind of criteria of dependence. Where those patients are identified that clearly meet criteria for dependence, some of the more common treatments that are used are things like our opioid agonist treatments like methadone and buprenorphine. So there's a very strong evidence base for the use of those for pharmaceutical opioid dependence and opioid dependence in general. This review added kind of additional information that there is a number of reports of using these treatments, particularly buprenorphine, naloxone, to treat codeine dependence to good effect. And one of the things that we noted in this review is that the kinds of doses that were needed with buprenorphine naloxone were very similar to the sorts of doses that have been used in treatment of heroin dependence and other strong opioids. So not to assume that low doses are needed. Now, of course, if someone's presenting and they've been using codeine regularly, and you know, maybe in slightly higher doses, but they don't necessarily meet the criteria for dependence, that might be a case where you may not go straight to those treatments. And our review also identified that taper was often used, so reducing somebody off codeine, either using a different opioid or perhaps an opioid agonist treatment like buprenorphine, naloxone in the short term. We did find in the review that relapse following taper was relatively common, and we know that's common with opioid dependence in general. So I guess really taking a stepwise approach where maybe you attempt a taper, and if that doesn't work, being prepared to consider a longer-term treatment like buprenorphine, naloxone in the framework of opioid substitution treatment or opioid replacement treatment if that first taper doesn't work out.
Are there withdrawal effects?
Yeah, so one of the things that was reported is quite often when people were managed, particularly, for example, in a hospital admission, they'd cease codeine, that they did have significant opioid withdrawal symptoms, and they weren't always entirely managed by the use of symptomatic medications.
Mm.
So it is, I mean, I've come across the perception that codeine being a weaker opioid might not lead to sort of significant opioid dependence, but certainly what we see both in the review and in other studies that I've been involved in is it can contribute to really significant levels of neuroadaptation, and people do need medical support to be able to stop in many cases.
Do you believe that the rescheduling is a good thing?
Look, I think when the benefits versus the risks of codeine have been weighed up, it certainly seems that for these low-dose codeine products, the benefits, you know, aren't much greater than those simple analgesics on their own. And we now are lucky enough to have some, you know, newer products that maybe have less risks and are more effective.
Yeah.
I think that when that's balanced with these, with the harms that we've seen, you know, relatively frequent sort of misuse reported in the National Drug Strategy Household Survey, increasing numbers of people presenting to drug and alcohol services for treatment of dependence, and of course these really significant hospital admissions that keep being identified. I think when we look at that balance, it seems that if the medication doesn't give that much benefit over other alternatives and these severe harms are emerging,
yeah,
it does seem like we're moving in the right direction.
Do you think there's a hidden group of patients out there who didn't know they were dependent and are suddenly going to discover that they are?
Look, it's possible. There has been a lot of work talking to health professionals who then in turn will hopefully have been talking to their patients who have been seeking codeine in the last few months to let them know that this change is coming up. One thing that we found in our previous research is often people do get a little bit caught by surprise and just how hard it is to stop codeine use. And the term, you know, an accidental addict is one that's been used a couple of times where people have started using this medication for pain and the use has gone on a bit longer than they thought. Maybe the dose has ended up being a bit higher than they intended and it has been difficult to stop. So it is possible, I believe, that there'll be some people that just may not have realised how hard it would be to stop and might be seeking help in the coming weeks to months as their codeine supply runs out.
It sounds like you're pretty hopeful, though, that this isn't a dependence that is very hard to reverse or get out of. You sound like there are some really good, strong treatments available.
Yeah, look, from the treatment research that we've seen, it certainly appears that when people are given proper doses, like therapeutic doses of buprenorphine, naloxone, for example,
mm-hmm.
we see pretty good rates of retention. People are able to cease their codeine use. Some of the qualitative comments that people give about the treatment is that they feel so much better and not having to run around to lots of pharmacies to try and procure codeine. It takes
yes.
a huge stop them. And so even though there's a lot of reluctance to enter treatment, we do see evidence that patients find the treatment acceptable and that the treatment works well for them. So I do have some optimism that if we can, you know, really thoughtfully have these conversations with patients about what the options are and if things are presented in a way that's, you know, relatively flexible, and particularly where possible providing treatment in primary care, because many of these patients have great prognostic indicators, things like they do have good social supports. They're often employed. They don't have histories of other substance use.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a history of injecting opioids. So a lot of those markers that that patients may do very well in treatment. So I think there is reason for hope. Thanks so much for that.
Thank you for your time. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.